content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Nicole Hunter from the Triangle Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine, September 2018 edition. And on the cover of this edition is the one and only Naomi Campbell. And last week I didn't get a chance to cover her story, so that's the first one that we're going to get started with today, because I know that some of you viewers want to, you know, hear about what the cover story details. So it's called Hot in Harlem. So in a comeback story of epic proportions, designer Dapper Dan stays true to his uptown roots as he retakes the fashion world by storm with a little help from his friend, supermodel Naomi Campbell. The fabled career of Dapper Dan can be summed up in one world, or one word, legendary. The New York-based fashion designer, whose given name is Daniel Day, parlayed his love of style into a successful clothing boutique in the flamboyant 80s before losing that business to an expensive lawsuit in the early 90s. Now, after years of designing for a devoted clientele away from the public's eye, he's at the helm of a luxury collection in partnership with one of the biggest fashion houses in the world. Of course, Dapper Dan has always been an industry giant in his own right. A Harlem boy to his core, he built his fashion empire right on his home turf. From 1982 to 1992, he owned a store on 125th Street, where he quickly became popular with gangsters in the hood who coveted flash. Dan's claim to fame was the customized toile he crafted using the logos of fashion's fanciest labels, Gucci, Louis Vuitton, Fendi, MCM, and more. What some considered knockoffs, Dan deemed knockups. When it came time that I could be creative with the brands, he says, I kept that same instinct and blackenized them. Soon, popular R&B and hip-hop artists were clamoring for his creations. Salt and Pepper, LL Cool J, Rakim, Bobby Brown, and Aaliyah were just a few of the bold-faced names who wrapped themselves in Dan's designs. His glitziest clients even had the interior of their cars outfitted in Dapper Dan logo covered fabric. Dan hustled and thrived, taking his street cred to the highest levels of fashion and setting the tone and the style for decades in Harlem and beyond. But his reign ended abruptly one fateful night when Mike Tyson got into a fight with fellow star boxer Mitch Green outside of Dan's store. The media coverage around the altercation exposed the designer's logo lifting to the established fashion world, and Dan was slapped with copyright infringement lawsuits that ended in a crippling six-figure fine. For the next 25 years, Dan dropped out of sight, slowly resurrecting his business by designing only for special VIP clients, including boxer Floyd Mayweather Jr. and singer Mary J. Blige. But in May 2017, Dapper Dan was once again thrust into the spotlight when Gucci was called out for allegedly plagiarizing one of his designs. The Italian fashion house had presented a fur bomber jacket with huge blouse and sleeves covered in the brand's interlocking G logo at its 2018 Cruise Collection show. The look closely resembled the design Dan had created back in 1989 for Olympic track and field gold medalist Diane Dixon, except that Dan's coat had used the Louis Vuitton monogram. Black Twitter quickly compared side-by-side images of the designs and called for an apology from Gucci. The backlash was a catalyst for one of the most intriguing fashion alliances in recent history. Gucci reps reached out to Dan in a meeting of the minds that has resulted in an exciting new clothing line and the opening of a Gucci Dapper Dan Atelier in the heart of Harlem. So Dan's first collection in this partnership, which features vibrant 3D print fabrics, is an nod to his Harlem roots and to the designs that put him on the map. His labels are often sewn on outside and license plate scale, representing hip-hop culture, a love of flash luxury, and in-your-face boldness. Meanwhile, on his current On the Run 2 tour with husband Jay-Z, Beyonce is donning Bespoke's looks, and Mary J. Blige performed at the Summer's Essence Festival in Dapper Dan ensembles. Behind the opulent screen of his own impeccable style is a self-made American man whose dad worked three jobs to make ends meet for Dan and his six siblings. Early one afternoon a few weeks ago, I sat with the legend himself on the ground floor of his luxuriously appointed Harlem haberdashery to reflect on the struggles, the sacrifices, and his soaring success. Andre Leon Detali, he's the editor for this particular article on Dapper Dan. And so he's asking him some questions, and then Dan is answering the questions that he's asking. So Andre's first question is, what's your earliest memory of the way you want it to look? Did you have this personal style in your childhood? And Dapper Dan's response is, I was 9 years old when I reached a level of consciousness where I wanted to be a really sharp guy. It was probably when the khakis came out and the buckle in the back. And then all of a sudden, button-down dress shirts were in colors. My father bought me the khakis, but we couldn't afford the button-downs. So I took a white shirt and bought Tintex, which is fabric dye. My mother nearly killed me because I used one of her big pots. I put the Tintex in the pot, put the shirt in, dyed it, then cut little holes in the collar for the buttons and sewed the buttons on. So it was in you to have this creative output for fashion. But let's fast forward to the first Dapper Dan store. What was the dream? Well, the dream came from the fact I needed something to do. I didn't want to be stuck on the corners like the rest of the guys. Since I knew the subculture, the gangsters, and everyone, I opened the store with the intention of catering to them. One day, a customer came into the store with the Louis Vuitton pouch. Everybody got super excited, and a light went off in my head. Imagine what they would feel about a whole outfit, and that began my journey. I went about studying everything I could find on textile printing. I experimented with all kinds of inks until I came across one that I could put on leather. Next thing you know, I had gangsters in Harlem walking around looking like luggage. That's extraordinary. From the Tintex in your mama's pot, this is where the dream became a reality. When did the famous hip-hop artists start to become clients? I would say the most famous were the ones who had the money. That would be the Fat Boys. They were the first ones to come to the store with $100 bills. Before that, the rappers used to have to wait outside until the gangsters left. I also had gangsters with rappers from Illinois, Connecticut, and all across the country who wanted their cars done. I was busy. And you were running a 7-day-a-week business, right? 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 360 days a year. I didn't close the store for a single day for 10 years straight. It got so busy I had to build an apartment in the back so my children, Jelani and Danique, could come over. What made it all fall apart? One day, Mike Tyson shows up. He's a regular customer of mine, but on this day, he gets into a fight with another boxer outside my store. That brought all the attention. After that, the brands began to notice and started issuing cease and desist orders to stop me from using their monograms. Then this lawyer came into the store, gave me an order, and took everything. That lawyer was Sonia Sotomayor, who is now a justice of the United States Supreme Court. That story is in her book as one of the highlights of her career. This is the reason you had to fold and close up shop? Exactly. She won a suit against me on behalf of her client, which cost me $250,000. But you didn't give up the dream. You kept on. I did, but I went underground from 1992 until now. I was the best kept secret. All the rappers, stylists knew where I was. But then here comes Gucci. They decide they're going to have some Dapper Dan-inspired pieces in their show, and the internet internet erupt. Yes, social media went haywire. The story went viral. I thought it was just another case of someone coming to take my ideas. I had already seen two top fashion lines copying me in their shows. But behold, Gucci reached out and said, "We are ready to make you an offer. Not for a collaboration, but for a partnership." And in addition to that, they've allowed me to open an atelier in Harlem. That is amazing. It's a Cinderella story. You're bigger than Cinderella. This is a once-in-a-lifetime story. It is extraordinary that Gucci did this. Most brands do not reach out to Black anything. As quiet as it has been kept, you are an important and iconic member of the fashion world. Thank you. Let me tell you, the dream became even more real when you came into the store. You are a king to me. Thank you. What does the future hold for you? I've got a book coming out next year with Random House and a movie in development. Sony Pictures has bought the rights to my life, and I was told Francis Ford Coppola wants to do it. What does it feel like to be a Black man who has given back so much in terms of style to the place where you were born? The reality of the impact I've had is just catching up with me. And when you came through those doors, that sealed the deal. And again, this article was written by fashion insider Andre Leon Talley, which is the former editor at large of Vogue magazine and the author of several books in the industry. And he currently lives in White Plains, New York. So he's the person that in this article that got to interview Dapper Dan. So I'm sure there's more to come with him, considering now he has a partnership with Gucci and also has a store, looks like in Harlem, New York. Go on to another article. One of our favorite funny girls, Yvonne Orji, plays dress up in five of fall's most fabulous trends. It's not hard to see why folks are obsessed with Yvonne Orji, the actress who plays Molly Carter, the best friend of Issa Rae's character of HBO's hit series Insecure. Is just an endearing off-screen as she is on-screen. Her Instagram feed is a colorful curation of her daily adventures as a Hollywood star. The inspirational quotes speak to her undying faith in God, and there are plenty of hilarious shenanigans shown that will leave you in stitches. Basically, you want her to be your BFF in real life. Recently, we've noticed more and more posts that highlight her eye-catching style, which is one of the many reasons why she was tapped for Essence Edition of Fashion. But if you let her tell it, the Nigerian-born celeb wasn't always so in vogue. I grew up in the era of Criss Cross, Orji explains. So for me, I was like Left Eye or T-Boz from TLC in terms of their fashion. Orji, who can be seen in the movie Night School, which is in theaters this month, considers herself a tomboy by nature, and when she was younger would sneak clothes from the closet of her three older brothers. If there's a way for there to be a sweatshirt, sweatpant dress, then it would be like, yes, she says, joking. Nevertheless, she has come a long way from oversized jeans and jerseys, whether she's stepping out on the red carpet in a floor-sweeping emerald green gown, as she did at this year's year's NBA Awards, or rocking some of the season's biggest trends throughout these pages. So the 34-year-old actress clearly has some chops. I just like to be comfortable, and when it's time to get glammed up or dressed up, then it's like, okay, let's elevate it a little bit. The stakes are high. As the cannabis industry evolves into a multi-billion dollar market, black women potpreneurs, I guess I'm pronouncing it right, potpreneurs are claiming their piece of the pie. So, let's be real. Most of us probably didn't grow up dreaming of becoming powerhouses in the cannabis industry, as it was with Wanda James, the first black woman to own a dispensary in Colorado. The idea of working in weed most likely wasn't talked about in your household. Despite being a military brat, James has always called Colorado home. Even though her state decriminalized marijuana in 1975, she never imagined the industry turning into what it is today. In college and as a young adult, I didn't even consider that this would be a career, she says. James started out as a serial entrepreneur, running several restaurants and consulting companies. It wasn't until she met her biological brother for the first time in 1999 that she had a professional change of heart. She found out that at age 19, her brother had been arrested for possession of 4.5 ounces of marijuana, sentenced to 10 years as a maximum or at a maximum security prison. He spent four of those years picking cotton. When I learned what had happened to my brother, it pissed me off, James says, after serving on Barack Obama's National Finance Committee in late 2008. James wanted to put an African-American face on legislative efforts. My husband and I decided that we were going to open a dispensary and be political about the social justice issues surrounding cannabis. Today, they own and operate Simply Pure, a Denver-based cannabis, edibles, and cooking company, and medical and recreational marijuana dispensary, says James. We started speaking out in 2010, and we haven't stopped. Altering the image. James works tirelessly to encourage other black women to become pioneers in one of the fastest growing fields in the United States. According to a recent report from the cannabis industry analyst ArcView Market Research, the legal marijuana market is expected to generate $39.6 billion in overall economic impact by 2021. As for the demographic dominating this new green rush, it's white men. Why aren't people of color who have suffered the most from the devastating effects of the war on drugs benefiting more from the economic boom? James believes the first step is erasing the negativity attached to the plant. The folks in the industry are some of the most motivated people I've ever met. They are up early. They are up late. They are working on their businesses. They are running other businesses. And the black women are trailblazers. We have to be. We know the law because we have to. We've got to change the stigma of who uses cannabis and why. Deshida Dawson agrees. She's the founder and CEO of MJM Strategy, a digital-focused strategic management firm that specializes in rebranding the cannabis industry. She says improving the perception starts with education. We need a roadmap, she explains, something that shows how you stay out of prison, how you avoid being shunned out of your church community, how you can do this and still be a good mom. The stigma is high for us because as women of color, we've seen our dads, our brothers, our sons, and our cousins targeted for this. We have to overcome that fear. The Princeton graduate who has a corporate background at several Fortune 500 companies, believes that telling our stories will help make strides toward change. The women at Astro Hayes, a multimedia outfit highlighting the work and lifestyles of women of color and multicultural communities in the field, are doing just that. The narrative that was being pushed by the mainstream as it pertained to people of color and cannabis was really bleak and uninspiring, notes Sarita Wright, who started Astro Hayes with two of her former co-workers, Kali Wilder and Safan Floyd. No one was showcasing people of color in a positive light and giving them resources. We know that there were people out there who looked like us and that their stories needed to be shared. Finding your spark. Kebra Smith Bolden is one such success story. She says building a cannabis business is all about finding your niche. She's a registered nurse who serves as the CEO of Cannabis Consultants of Connecticut and president of Canna Health, a holistic health and wellness center. She also started the Connecticut chapter of Women Grow, a nationwide networking organization that empowers women to become entrepreneurs in the area or in the arena. The first thing I generally ask people is, what kind of work are you doing now? She says, pretty much anything that you can think of, you can add cannabis to it, and it's relevant. It works and it's profitable. If you think being a grower or a dispensary owner is the only option, think again. There are non-plant handling enterprises that can help you bloom where you're planted. From chefs and real estate agents to security law and PR firms, opportunities are sprouting everywhere. Accounting, for example, is an area where women can thrive. Dealing with tax laws and trying to figure out how an operation. Let me go back and read this last paragraph. So, accounting, for example, is an area where women can thrive. Dealing with tax laws and trying to figure out how an operation can be profitable is a skill set that could easily be transferred, Wilder says. Other possible ventures: skin and hair care products, yoga instructions, social media management, event planning, and even weed-friendly lodging. And let's not forget about the many amounts of marijuana that one could sell. Rolling papers, grinders, smell-proof bags, and other accessories, particularly with feminine details, are hot items. Getting the green light. Ready to help diversify the greenscape? First and foremost, you have to learn the politics of pot, because not everyone is on board. If you don't live in one of the 9 states or in the District of Columbia, which are places where recreational use is permitted, then your business will need to be centered on medical marijuana, which is currently legal in 30 states. It's super important to understand what's happening in your state, city, or town, and ultimately what's happening in Congress as it relates to cannabis, says Shanita Penny, president of the Minority Cannabis Business Association, also called MCBA Board of Directors. The MCBA's commission is to create equal access for minority cannabis entrepreneurs through networking events, monthly webinars, and federal lobby days. The nonprofit helps members stay abreast of the ever-changing policies and regulations. also stay connected to a network. There's no one-man show happening in this industry. Penny points out you can be a wonderful business person and a wonderful leader in other spaces, but cannabis is unique. Your village or canna farm, as some call it, is the circle that will help you stay and the know about potential educational, investment, and partnership opportunities. Finding your circle can also help you secure startup money. If you don't have the capital to get your idea off the ground, find someone who does. Maybe they don't want to be the face of a company, or maybe they don't have the time to devote to building a business and getting it licensed and up and running. So they're looking to partner with folks who do, advises Penny, who's held management and consulting roles at major companies in diverse fields. Black women in this country lead in entrepreneurship, yet we have the least access to capital. We make it happen in every other industry. There's no reason why we can't make it happen here. As experts agree that poppreneurs have to be innovative and getting their enterprises funded. That's because under federal law, marijuana is still prohibited, and even though it's illegal in an increasing number of states, most banks refuse to do business with companies connected to the plant in any way. So instead of relying on bank loans, James suggests the best way to raise money is to put together a business plan based on the laws and regulations in your state, and then find investors. You have to be willing to talk about your business, she says. Make sure you have your ducks in a row, know exactly what it is that you want to do, have your research ready or your research together. Once you know how much capital you need, you can go out and raise it. If you're having trouble getting individual investors to sign up, don't give up. It would be fantastic to see a group of black women come together and raise the money we need, James says. Find each other. Create the village together. You may not have 6 million, but maybe 20 of you together can have 6 million. And here's some added motivation. Sisters aren't joining in the green rush just for the coins. Increasing our representation in this business means we have the power to keep and reinvest more dollars in our community and effect change on the policies that have targeted our people. We need ownership with participation in this industry because we've borne the disproportionate burden of the war on drugs. Penny reminds us, we have been locked up. We have been arrested and over-sentenced by a targeted campaign against black and brown people. So now that cannabis is being legalized, it's only right that we be able to benefit from this lucrative new industry. And on that note, it looks like that we actually have run out of time for today's episode of Essence Magazine. Be sure to listen next time, and I hope that you have enjoyed it. I'm Nicole Hunter, reading for the Triangle Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long and till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.